From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1787 during the Constitutional Convention. The Founding Fathers spent weeks in heated debate over a number of subjects, including how to elect a president. Some argued that it should be up to Congress. After all, members of Congress would be elected to represent the people. Well, some founders thought it should be a rather simple democratic popular vote. In the end, they achieved a kind of compromise in what became known as the Electoral College. The Electoral College has been heatedly debated in recent years, thanks in large part to two of the recent five presidential elections in which the winner of the Electoral College lost the popular vote. Pew Research's newest polling finds that if Americans were voting today on the Electoral College, they'd throw out the college in a landslide, 58-40, shifting to a simple popular vote model. But even that split's heavily partisan. The vast majority of Democrats want to ditch the Electoral College. It's probably because they've won the most votes in seven of the last eight presidential elections, but won the presidency in just five of those eight contests. Republicans, meanwhile, strongly support the Electoral College, which for the moment is their best hope to win the White House going forward. Interestingly, when Americans are polled, they tend to understand the basic mechanism of the Electoral College, but Americans tend to be surprised to learn that even the Electoral College votes are not weighted evenly. Here's an example. Take Wyoming, our least populous state. Wyoming gets three electoral votes. New York State has 34 times the population of Wyoming. If we had 34 times their electoral votes, we'd have 102 electoral votes for the winner in the presidential election. In reality, we have 29. Wyoming voters get a greater say in the presidential election than New York voters, a much greater say when you look at it that way. And this is true in case after case in many different states. Maybe you're thinking, well, California is the biggest electoral prize with 55. Maybe that's closer to parity. Not even close. California has 69 times the population of the state of Wyoming, but only 18 times as many electoral votes. Texas gets shortchanged too, by the way. So does Florida. We could do this for the whole hour. Is there a sound reason, a good justification for the Electoral College? Its defenders say yes, and it is often misunderstood. Its detractors say the Electoral College is a relic that should be mothballed. Well, let's try to understand it better, and let's welcome our guests for the hour. Joseph Burgess is a data curator for the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at Cornell University. Joseph, thanks for making time for the program.
Thanks so much for having me back on.
And welcome to Alan Guelzo. Dr. Guelzo is the director of the James Madison Program Initiative on Politics and Statesmanship and senior research scholar in the Council of the Humanities at Princeton University, also the co-author of a chapter on the Electoral College in the book Picking the President, Understanding the Electoral College. Dr. Guelzo, thanks for making time for the program.
Well, it's very good to be here.
Alan, you've written, and you write in that chapter in the book, that there aren't a whole lot of aspects of American voting and civics more misunderstood than the Electoral College. Why do you think that is?
Well, for one thing, people imagine that we have a system of popular voting that somehow the Electoral College works beside. Actually, we don't. The Constitution only has one system for electing presidents, and that is the Electoral College. There's no mechanism in the Constitution for a popular vote. So many people are surprised by this. I can remember a long time ago thinking, I think I'd like to find that section in the Constitution that describes the popular vote so I can compare it with the electoral vote. Well, there wasn't one. The Constitution only has the Electoral College as the means of electing the President of the United States. That poses a number of interesting questions. Of course, the first question is, why did they do it? Second question is it fair? And the third question is, how would you go about changing it short of a constitutional amendment? And if you want to begin with a third of those, the answer is a rather formidable cliff to scale. Amending the Constitution is not an easy process. And in the case of the Electoral College, what you'd have to do is not only amend the Constitution, you would have to write an entirely new mechanism for electing a president into the Constitution itself. When you consider that the description of the Electoral College comprises about 10% of the entire wording of the Constitution, then you are really looking at a major constitutional challenge, maybe even a major constitutional crisis in trying to tamper with, deal with, rewrite, or in some other way, refashion the notion of the way that we elect the president. So just on those terms, answering that question, right away you begin to see that the answer to questions about the Electoral College are never quite as simple and straightforward as they seem.
Joseph, do you think Americans misunderstand the Electoral College from the basic mechanism to how to change it to the intention of it?
Great question. I do think Americans have a basic understanding of how the Electoral College works. I don't know that they necessarily have an understanding of the best mechanic to best way to change that, if we did indeed want to change from an Electoral College system to some sort of popular vote or other type of system. I'm really interested in the idea that you already brought up the, and I was going to, so you beat me to it, the polling about the Electoral College system, and that the sort of national will and national mood is more interested in this type of national popular vote as a mechanism for electing a president. And I think even when we ask that poll, or when we do any national poll, we're really sort of already accepting the idea that the national popular vote, the mood of the nation, matters, not just on a state-by-state basis, but that we do have to accept that we're part of a nation where each vote could, if we wanted it to, count equally in electing the president.
Do you see value? Do you see virtues in this, Joseph? Because I understand some of the frustrations that some Americans have, and I'm sure you'll reflect some of their views, maybe with some data behind it. But do you see virtues in the Electoral College?
Well, the short answer is no. And the long answer is also no. So, you know, I really don't. I think it's a relic of a system that has obvious, you know, historical uses. It's very clear to many people why we adopted it in the first place. But in the current America where we are today, I really don't see it as a benefit. And I think it has many structural flaws beyond just not reflecting the popular vote or the popular will. I think there are other really serious negatives and almost no positives to it.
Okay. Dr. Guelzo, so let's go back to sort of the roots of why the founders went with an Electoral College and whether you still see the virtue in their reasoning. Go ahead.
Well, fundamentally, we are a federal union. That is what the Constitution is about. That is how we were created. We're not a single unified monolith, politically speaking. We are a federation of states. And this is the way the Constitution, from the first word to the last word, describes the relationship between states, individual, the branches of the government, and so on and so forth. The Electoral College is settled upon almost literally at the last minute of the Constitutional Convention. As part of that, the feeling being that a popular election, and that was seriously proposed. In fact, it was the first model proposed by the delegates to the Constitutional Convention when the convention was discussing this. But that was set aside because the fear was that if you had a popularly elected president, directly elected by the people, what you could very easily get was a dictator, someone, a Caesar or an Alexander, who would say, look, I am speaking for the popular will, I'm speaking for a popular mandate, and thus brush aside the legislative branch, brush aside the judicial branch, and rule on the strength of that popular mandate. And that's a real problem, because when you look at other nations which also have direct popular election, the list you get is not encouraging. I mean, it includes Iran, Russia. These are not exactly what you'd call models of democracy. You think on the first blush that a direct popular vote would be the most democratic way of doing it. But in practice, that's not necessarily the case. Whereas if you look at nations that we do recognize as being democratic nations, almost all of them have some system similar to our Electoral College. They don't use the terminology, but for instance, in Great Britain, no one's really disputing the fact that Great Britain is a free and open society. It has a parliamentary system. Within that system, nobody votes for the prime minister. You vote for a party, and the person who becomes prime minister is the head of that party. And that is a sort of electoral college because it's a system which is broken down. It's not direct. In Germany, for instance, you have what really amount to two elections that take place simultaneously, one for the chancellor and the other for the president. And frankly, I find it an extremely confusing. I'm glad I'm not German. Because voting in a German election, I would find it extremely confusing. But that is the way things are done, Germany being a federal republic. So fundamentally, what we're looking at with the Electoral College is a piece of our federalism. We are a federal union, and the compromise that does eventually come forward. Because the alternative, as I think you mentioned in the opening, your opening speech, the alternative was really, do we have a direct popular election? Well, I could get us Julius Caesar. Or we could have Congress elect the president. Oh, but then you're going to have a president who is purely a creature of factions in Congress. It's really at the very end of the Constitutional Convention that they hit upon the idea of this two-stage process, so that you have a popular election in the states, and then you have the states, through their electors, casting votes for a president. And that two-stage process was felt by the Constitutional Convention to be the best way of navigating between the potential threat of some kind of popular demagogue or the threat posed by a president who would be nothing but the creature of factions in Congress. And we've moved forward with that for a good long way. The fact that it represents this principle of federalism also, I think, has to give us some pause, because the rest of the Constitution is built around federalism, too. If we want to get rid of the Electoral College, then on the same logic, we should really get rid of the United States Senate, because that's just as unrepresentative. Every state, no matter what its size, gets two senators. So let's get rid of the U.S. Senate. The same logic would point us in that direction. Let's, in fact, dismantle just about all the structures of federalism that we have in the Constitution. I'm not sure that we want to do that, but that would be the conclusion we'd have to come to as we reflect on what the Electoral College means in the overall context of the Constitution.
All right, Joseph, do you find any flaws in the arguments there?
You know, the first thing I have to say is don't threaten me with a good time. Everything you're saying is a sort of, you know, I do think we need to worry about
hold on a second. What you're saying is the notion of abolishing the Senate is a feature and not a bug to you.
It's fantastic. Love it. Keep talking. So I think I'll address two separate points. I do think we need to be worried about the idea of a strong executive, especially now where the executive has such strong powers, often with a divided Congress. And I think the answer to that is making elections, not just the presidency, but the Senate and the House, or however we want to determine how Congress is elected, also more reflective of the popular vote. So it's a feature, not a bug, is how I would think of it. If the Senate and the House are also more reflective of the popular vote, then, like the presidency in this sort of doom scenario, they would also have that sort of claim to represent the people, to represent the populace. And I do think that's a good thing. I think ultimately we want a population who can vote and have that vote directly affect the outcome and be part of a system where your vote matters in setting policy.
Okay, but Joseph, when we look at, for example, you know, when you look at the U.S. Senate, a lot of folks have pointed out that, yes, you could pile up North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Idaho, Montana, and their population would be a small fraction of just beginning to represent, for example, a California, a Texas, a New York. But they, you know, they have 10 senators among those states. And yes, I understand, you know, maybe the complaint populationally, but I also understand the point that the professor is making when it comes. Dr. Guelzo is essentially saying we are, a federation of states here, and there were protections built in, so it wasn't just sort of, urban population centers and certain enclaves that would have all of the power. That there was some kind of protection for less populous territories and states, and that we go away from that, and the whole focus and maybe some of the intent goes out the window. Do you see a problem with that, Joseph?
Well, I'll talk about the big cities argument for a second, in that the Senate is really biased far more towards these rural, low-population states in a way that the Electoral College isn't necessarily in practice. And I think what the Electoral College does is it really makes some big cities matter quite a bit. I think the swings in Miami that we saw recently were very crucial to determining how Florida ultimately voted, and Florida's a swing state. But it makes New York City's votes not count at all. So instead of the Electoral College making rural states matter, it makes close states matter, and that can include these states with these large cities. Talking about the Senate, which does have more of a bias over representing these lowly populated states, primarily rural, without big cities, I think ultimately we have to sort of renegotiate the constitutional structure that we're in order to give Americans more of a voice. I don't think it's good or fair, just based on federalism and the structure from, you know, hundreds of years ago, that these lowly populated states continue to have an overrepresentation within the Senate.
Dr. Guelza, do you see it as an overrepresentation, for example, in the U.S. Senate when Wyoming, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, those states are represented? I mean, Wyoming has fewer people than the county I'm in, Monroe County, and they have two U.S. senators. Is that an overrepresentation?
Well, I don't know necessarily on principle, because the solution might be simply to break up some of the larger states. If Wyoming, for instance, has two senators and one representative, it gets those three electoral votes, and therefore an individual Wyoming citizen has more electoral heft by that means than someone in New York or someone in California. Well, it seems to me the solution is let's break up New York, let's break up California. Let's break up California into two states. Northern California would love to secede from the rest of California, and where was it ever set in eternal stone that California has to be in the boundaries that were set for it in 1850. Likewise, New York. I mean, New York's boundaries go back to before the beginning of the Republic. Why should we feel that we have to abide by that? Let's break up the states and we'll get more senators and more people speaking directly to their senators. Let Monroe County be a state on its own in that respect. Well, of course, that would create some interesting difficulties, not the least for how do you put all those people together under one dome in Washington, D.C.? But it does speak to the problem here of federalism. And I'm grateful in one respect that Joseph is fairly candid, that, you know, let's deconstruct the entire Constitution. Let's take the whole thing apart. The Constitution is antique. The Constitution is ancient. Let's get rid of it. If that is what we want to do, and if that's how we want to poll people, I would be very interested in seeing the results. But let's at least understand that once you start the process on the Electoral College with that anti-federal logic, then you have really got to take the entire rest of the Constitution apart. You're going to need a new Constitution for the United States, some kind of new governing instrument. There's going to have to be some kind of national convention to do it. And by the time we've got done with it all, I'm not sure what it's all going to look like. Certainly, we will not look like the United States of America again.
Well, and I'll let Joseph respond to that in just a moment. But let me just kind of follow up with one, I think, important clarification for listeners who maybe agree with Joseph on the U.S. Senate, for example. Dr. Guelza, you explained that just at baseline, the notion of a pure popular vote electing a president, the founders feared a Caesar. And that there is it sounds to me that you think that there is at least some logic in thinking that there is still a concern that we could end up with someone authoritarian. I mean, certainly we got pretty close to an authoritarian, maybe a poseur, but it's still an authoritarian via the Electoral College this time around. But I mean, I certainly understand the argument. When it comes to the U.S. Senate, what I think needs to be done better is I think there needs to be just better civic education and better explanation to Americans who look at the western states that are barely populated, and they all have two senators. And they look at New York State, and they look at California, they look at Texas, they look at Florida, and they see two senators apiece, and they think that that does not make sense to me. What is the argument for, if not this system, then what for those states? Then what for the people who live in those states where it is much less populated? If not, then what?
Well, then I'd come back and almost turn the question around and say, if not what we have, then what would possibly replace it? One of the reasons that the Senate was constructed the way it was, with two senators apiece, was a way of speaking to the fundamental division in the Constitutional Convention as to how representation should take place in the United States Congress. There were small states which were very concerned that they were going to be completely squeezed out of the legislative process by states like Virginia, which had, by contrast, enormous populations, or at least enormous populations by 1787 standards. And their fear was, if we have a single house legislature where everything is popularly elected, as we have in the House of Representatives today, then small states are going to be crushed by the influence of larger states acting in that single chamber Congress. So the situation was resolved in the convention by saying, well, we will have a two house legislature. And the upper house, the Senate, will have equal representation for all the states so that small states will not find themselves taken advantage of and otherwise put to disadvantage by the larger states. And that would be just as true today. If, in fact, you said to the stretches of the United States that are represented in the Senate by Wyoming, by the Dakotas, and so on like that, if you said, well, we're just going to bundle you together and you, the whole bunch of you will only get two senators, well, how much protection, how much security would the people of those regions have from, let's say, the aggressive intentions of some parties in Congress to do things that would be harmful to them? That is a concern. That was a concern in 1787. It would be a concern today.
I take the point.
The way we wanted to fiddle with the structure.
What's an example of something that could be harmful to people who live in those areas?
I don't know. I don't live in those areas. I would have to ask them.
Okay. No, that's fair enough. So, all right. So I'm going to let Joseph respond, and then we've got a number of phone calls and comments from listeners. But Joseph, go ahead.
You know, I did want to first say I don't think we need to throw out the entire Constitution. We've successfully amended it a number of times before. I'm sure we would be able to, as a nation, get through that process somehow. Maybe the politics of it would be difficult, but it's certainly not something that would necessarily tear our nation asunder. The other part I wanted to talk about, or just promote quickly, is I don't know if either of you or our listeners are familiar with the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And the idea of that is, instead of a constitutional amendment, how this would work is that states adding up to 270 electoral votes would agree to appoint all of their electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote. So it's a way of thinking about these issues, or possibly solving the problem, if you want to call it, of the Electoral College without having to go through a constitutional amendment. I believe 15 or 16 states already signed up. It's not a pie in the sky thing. It's a number of states have already signed legislation to be a part of this state-by-state compact.
That would be effectively an abolition of the Electoral College, but you're saying that you do see a possible mechanism to get it done. Okay. I take that point. Go ahead,
Dr.
Brosnan.
That is a mechanism. The problem is it's not a constitutional one. Article 1, Section 10 prohibits states from entering into any agreement or compact with another state without congressional approval. It would probably, and I would see the possibilities of congressional approval for that being next to nil. There would also be challenges in the courts. I just don't think that would get the ball anywhere down the field. And the second thing is about the compact is there's no enforcement mechanism. So 15 or 16 states, yes, have signed on and said we'll abide by it. But suppose you actually get to the election and a state goes in a way that it had not expected it was going to go. What do the electors do? Do they say, okay, we're going to continue to head in this other direction, or are they just going to say, sorry, we're backing out of the compact? There would be no penalty. There would be no enforcement. So the national interstate compact is a great idea in the sense that it's like one of these boards 10 feet long put across a chasm 10 feet wide. Looks great, but don't try to walk on it.
Well, fair enough on that point, but getting beyond mechanisms, Joseph, can you respond to the argument that Dr. Guelzo is making regarding the possible harm? Is there something injurious to the populations of these least populated states that we've been talking about if, for example, we abolished the U.S. Senate, or if we changed these systems that we've been talking about? Alan says that there is a possibility that the legislative priorities could be injurious to people who live in those states, and that the current system is protective against that.
Sure. I mean, I think if you want to look at it in terms of harm, that certainly would. They would have less legislative power, and that's a harm in some way. But our current system also does that. So it makes certain people have less legislative power. We're all familiar with it. That's why we're talking about this in the first place. So I think what we're shifting from, I'm not proposing people in big cities get two votes each. I think they should get one vote. And I think people in these rural states should get one vote, and they should all count equally at the end of the day. So we have a current harm that's being done to people who are in some of these big cities where their votes don't matter as much in determining what the legislature ultimately looks like. So we're trying to solve a harm and take away some benefits that ultimately shouldn't have been granted to these states. First place.
Okay, and I'll let Dr. Guelzo respond because that's an interesting point. I mean, Alan, when you say that there are some possible harms that could come if we change this system, particularly the U.S. Senate, what Joseph is saying is you are privileging the least populated territories and states, and they are the ones who get to determine legislative priorities that could be injurious to much greater and denser population centers.
Well, privilege sometimes depends on whose ox is being gored. Even the House of Representatives is itself, on that logic, fully as unrepresentative as the United States Senate, since, after all, electoral districts in the House of Representatives are drawn on the basis of state boundaries. Having one vote count in a city and one vote count in a rural area, you know, home on the range, that only makes sense if we just entirely eliminate all state boundaries as well, and completely redraw the district map for the House of Representatives in ignorance of that, and draw it broadly that way so that you have exactly the same number of people in each electoral district. And when people elect a representative to the House of Representatives, everyone is electing someone equally. There, you're going to have to completely reconstruct not only the Constitution, you will have to reconstruct all the states, you'll have to reconstruct the state constitutions, you'll have to reconstruct state legislatures. What you'll get at the end of that, I really have no idea, but I'm not sure that's a Russian roulette that I really want to play.
Our guests have different perspectives, and we're talking about the Electoral College and understanding its roots and how it functions today. You just heard Alan Guelzo, who is the director of the James Madison Program Initiative on Politics and Statesmanship and a senior research scholar in the Council of the Humanities at Princeton University. Joseph Burgess is with us, data curator for the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at Cornell University, speaking on behalf of his own expertise and work on this, by the way. And we've got a lot of phone calls and emails to take after this, our only break of the hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections. These are big changes that kids are experiencing during the pandemic, especially as we get ready for Thanksgiving and the holiday season. On Wednesday on Connections, we're going to have a conversation with the experts about how to navigate difficult conversations with kids, how to prepare them emotionally for changes, how to make sure their needs are met. And we'll answer your questions as well. That's Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Chaz in Chi-Life, first on the phone. Go ahead, Chaz.
Hi. I actually think it's kind of interesting that we're having this discussion in New York, because I think New Yorkers should understand better than anybody why the Electoral College is necessary. There is no Electoral College in New York, so if you're a candidate for statewide office, you don't have to focus anywhere north of the Westchester County line in order to get elected. And that ends up with people upstate getting largely ignored. And I think that's a problem. I think if Governor Cuomo does something that hurts people upstate, you should have to answer to them. I think you should get a call back if you call Kirsten Gillibrand's office to complain. But you really don't right now. Now, obviously, one of your guests is A-OK with the idea of, you know, the rural areas not having as much representation. But, you know, we are a federalist system. We have a constitution. And that constitution says majority rule, yes, but minority rights. And I think we risk losing that without an electoral college. And I think the proof of that is right here in this state.
All right, Chess. Thank you. Joseph, where is he wrong there? I mean, if we look at New York State, is he wrong to say that gubernatorial candidates don't ever have to stray outside of Westchester County?
You know, I do disagree with that. And I think it's partially a recency bias. I think we're all kind of used to the Cuomo administration at this point. But he's not the only governor that's ever been elected in the state. And if we're talking about other possible winning coalitions and their representation, traditionally in the last 50 years or so, when Republican candidates for governor win, they do so off huge turnout in the rural areas and in upstate, and then get the representation and policy outcomes that they'd like. I don't think we'll have a Democratic governor forever. And I think at that point, when a Republican gets elected, whatever that is, they'll do so off the strength of that turnout.
Okay.
And then get, yeah.
Well, Dr. Guelzo, the argument, the extension of the argument that Joseph and maybe others would make is that people vote, land doesn't vote. And we keep looking at these maps that are color-coded red and blue as if sort of density doesn't matter here. What do you make of the concern that we're overly focused on colors of the maps on land when land isn't doing the voting? Human beings are doing the voting.
Well, land isn't doing the voting, but people live on the land. And people, a lot of people, make their livelihoods in one way or another from the land. And that should mean something in its own terms. It's almost an argument. Putting aside the question of any kind of electoral college, putting aside indirect voting, is a way of saying that concentration of population is what sways. And that, in fact, is largely what happens. I mean, look at the state of Illinois, for instance. In Illinois, in the 2016 election, you had a situation where most of the state of Illinois, you have, what, 100 counties in Illinois, only 11 of those counties voted for Secretary Clinton. Nevertheless, she won the popular vote of Illinois, 3 million to 2 million, and that's because those 11 counties were all the Chicago area. She nevertheless got all of Illinois' 20 electoral votes. Is that really fair to the rest of the state? This is why I say maybe one thing we have to consider is not breaking up the Constitution or breaking up the United States government, but breaking up some of the states. Why not consider that? It would be a good deal less painful.
Well, and the other aspect of that, that's sort of related to that, to the point that you're making about how many counties individual candidates win when we look at the maps that way, there's a couple of listeners on that thread. Daryl writes to say, I'm concerned specifically about the winner-take-all rule in effect in so many states with the Electoral College. This disenfranchises voters within a state. And Preston pointed out that for, just as an example, in 2016, as we know, there are states that have been close in 2016 and 2020, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. It turns out that in 2016, Donald Trump won Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, all without a majority of votes. So he won with a plurality of votes in those states. And Preston has a problem with a candidate getting only a plurality, not a majority, but all of the electoral votes. Is that an issue, Dr. Guelzo?
Well, it is an issue. The problem is, what is the solution? Let's take Texas, for instance. Right now, there is pending a suit in the Texas courts, actually filed simultaneously in the Texas courts and in South Carolina, by David Boies, who's a very well-known attorney, very high-profile politically. And the argument of Boies' suit is against winner-take-all within the state of Texas. Because that's simply not fair. That means you have a large number of people who vote for one candidate, but because they are not the majority, they get no percentage of the electoral vote of Texas representing them. So the suggestion is proportional electoral votes. Let's divide up the electoral vote of Texas according to the percentage of the votes given to a particular candidate. And let us say that, for instance, if Mrs. Clinton had in 2016 won 35% of the popular vote of Texas, well, give her 35% of the electoral vote of Texas, and likewise, it would have been 65% in the other direction. Well, there's only one difficulty with that, and that is you can't divide electoral votes. These are electors, so you can't cut them like Solomon's baby and have a certain percentage of an electoral vote. Well, in Texas, that percentage actually represents something like about 1%. That would represent something like 250,000 people. So you're going to disenfranchise people if this is literally what we're calling disenfranchisement. You're going to disenfranchise people no matter what solution you come up with, winner take all percentages, or even get rid of the Electoral College completely. Someone's going to stand up and make a case for being disenfranchised. The question is, what is exactly the solution? We are not, when we're electing a president, we're not doing like a New England town hall where everybody is in the same place. And yes, it makes sense to have one person, one vote, because everybody knows everybody else. Everybody can see everybody else. We're talking 330 million people, though, for a national election, for a presidential election. Does it not make sense to break it down in stages? And yes, there will be inevitable inequities in the stages, but those inequities grow out of the fact that we're trying to manage an election for 330 million people. And we do the best we can with that. Do we do it perfectly? No, we never have had a perfect election. But let's bear in mind that some of our most imperfect national elections are the ones that have given us the greatest benefit. After all, Abraham Lincoln was elected president in 1860 with only 39% of the popular vote. Now, he won the majority of the Electoral College. But if the arguments that we're hearing about abolition of the Electoral College in favor of direct voting or some other form of voting, if those held sway, then we would have to say that the election of Abraham Lincoln was a mistake. We'd have to do likewise in 1824. In 1824, you had this, well, I'm going to reveal my own political prejudices here, anti-Andrew Jackson. I don't think too many people worry about that anymore. But all right, I'm not a Jacksonian. I'm not a fan of Andrew Jackson. He didn't win the election. And the reason he doesn't win the election is he doesn't get a majority in the Electoral College, despite the fact that he, in fact, won the popular vote. He does, 4 years later, get elected president, and what does he do? He smashes up the American economy. He commits near genocide against the Indian tribes of Georgia. I'm thinking that the Electoral College staved that off for 4 years. That's not a bad thing. So there are moments we can point to and say, look, there is a numerical inequity represented by this. Just 39% of the popular vote. Yeah, but it gave us Abraham Lincoln.
And so
let me make us pause.
Yeah, and so I want to get back to the phones. There's a lot of calls to take, but just briefly, Joseph, you brought up recency bias earlier, and is it potentially recency bias for many Democrats to say the Electoral College is a problem because of what's happened since 2000, whereas when you look at the whole of history, as Dr. Guelzo was saying, that we're going to see sort of ebbs and flows with the benefits, but the overall system should be preserved.
I absolutely agree with him in part, obviously. We have a lot of disagreements here. I think the recency bias, I was actually talking on Twitter about this beforehand, and that electoral coalitions shift over time. The Senate has this sort of permanent bias, or at least very long-lasting bias, towards these low population states. But the Electoral College has benefited Dems in the past. It's sort of an accident of history, I suppose, that in the most recent elections where it seemed to, I guess, I'll put in quotes, matter, it ended up benefiting the Republicans. But in Obama's 2008 and 2012 campaign, he actually ended up doing better in the tipping point states than he did in the popular vote. I don't think we necessarily need to see the Electoral College in strictly partisan terms.
Okay, fair enough. Well, let me continue to work through your phone calls because there's a lot. Joe in Rochester next. Go ahead, Joe.
So I have been listening intently. Gentlemen, you have largely got me impressed and confused at the same time. I wanted to address minority rule. A previous caller brought up minority rights. That's a very good point. But as our populations gravitate more and more towards the coasts, I see the possibility of minority rule through the Electoral College increasing. And I guess I would just like you to address that. I realize it is a very complicated solution that would be before us, but that is what concerns me about the Electoral College. It supports minority rule, and the presidential election is the only one that I'm aware of where that can happen.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. Joseph Burgess, not just minority rights, but minority rule. Is that a concern with the Electoral College?
I mean, unfortunately, I didn't hear quite all this question, but I'll just tackle what I can. I think we're currently under a stage of minority rule where certain populations, primarily, you know, low population states that are very heavily white, do have a persistent effect where it's not a complete minority rule, but they have such an outsized impact in our policies that they do end up having some form of minority rule over the rest of us. And I do think that's problematic.
Dr. Gwelzem?
Well, I think minority rule is always a question mark. The question in my mind, though, is minority rule going to become even more volatile an issue if you take out the Electoral College? The Electoral College acts as a stamp of legitimacy. And what I mean by that is when you look at the number of elections which have taken place in the United States, look at the way the Electoral College has tended to operate. It has most of the time, with only a handful of exceptions, acted to ratify the popular vote. In a democracy, legitimacy is the real question. Because in a democracy, what you have are large numbers of people who may find themselves in a minority, but large enough to say, why should that make a difference? Why should that majority, which we regard as being retrograde, wrong, evil, bad, so on like that, why should we let them rule because we, the minority, oh, we're right. So we're going to take our bat and ball and go someplace else and play. Well, that was exactly the conclusion that the Confederacy came to in 1860 to 61. And they attempted on that ground exactly to secede from the Union. They said, why should a minority, in this case, the 39% who voted for Abraham Lincoln, why should a minority rule over us? Those people are wrong. So you have a situation that we call the Civil War. The Electoral College, over and over again, has tended to say that legitimacy comes through a two-stage process. 17 out of 29 United States elections have been decided by 200 or more electoral votes. After you have a popular vote and then you have that ratified by an electoral vote, it's really hard for a truculent minority to say, oh, we're going to balk at that. We're going to subvert that. And what you get really then is not minority rule. What you get is the constant flux back and forth between minorities that, by means of democratic persuasion, are able to become majorities at some further point along. Then you have majorities which understand that they might one day be a minority, and therefore it's not a good idea to play with the civil liberties of the minority. And when you have that balance struck, that's when you have a real functioning democracy. And the Electoral College is one piece of conferring legitimacy on that process.
Can I just ask briefly from Chris and Gates, Dr. Guelzo, just for a little history. He says, it seems pretty clear that the framers settled on the Electoral College because it was the only way, coupled with the three-fifths rule, to get slaveholding states to go along with the Constitution. Pretending that this wasn't the reason does nothing to move our union forward. That's from Chris. What do you make of that, Dr. Guelzo?
I think that probably is an argument that does not have a lot of historical basis, because there's no connection in any of the discussions about the creation of the Electoral College and the Constitutional Convention which have any connection to slavery. Nobody was thinking about slavery at that point. Slavery is discussed in a different environment, but it's not discussed in connection with the election of a president or the Electoral College. The three-fifths rule was brought over from the Articles of Confederation. That was simply borrowed at that point. The framers in Philadelphia in 1787 did not invent that to go along with the Electoral College. And what's more, when the first Congress has its representation apportioned, it's not on the basis of a three-fifths clause, because up until 1790, there's no census on which to do that kind of apportionment. The apportionment that is created in the Constitutional Convention is in a lot of ways, is a very arbitrary one. And they did it on the basis of their own agreement with each other. They had no calculations, they had no numbers, and certainly no idea of numbers of slaves on which to make the basis of that original apportionment. So until 1792, probably until 1794, what you're really dealing with is a Congress which is not functioning on the basis of three-fifths. And then when you move on from that, it's very difficult to see, except for the election of 1800, where the three-fifths clause really delivered all this enormous clout in the Electoral College that is sometimes talked about. The Electoral College always had a certain torque towards the free states and the states and their representation in the Electoral College. The three-fifths clause never grants Southerners any real kind of majority, never grants them any kind of real power. And in fact, their power continues to diminish from election to election to election through the three-fifths clause, all the way from 1800 to 1860. So sometimes people make a great deal about the Electoral College being this thing which is invented to protect slavery, but the numbers don't bear it out, and what's more, the deliberations of the Constitutional Convention don't bear it out. They did talk about slavery, but not in connection with how to elect a president. They talked about how to elect a president, but not in connection with slavery.
All right, let me grab another phone call. Patrick in Brighton. Go ahead, Patrick. Keep it tight.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call. I got to say, I haven't agreed with anything I've heard from your guest up till now. And the small states like Wyoming, Kansas, they already have an advantage in the Senate. They have equal representation to every other state. They have an advantage from in Congress by means of gerrymandering districts, and they've also got this advantage from the Electoral College. It seems like it's too much of an advantage, and it's given us somebody like Trump, and it's contributing, I think, to the extreme bipartisanship or partisanship that we're seeing in the country now, the divide, because the majority doesn't feel like their voice is being heard.
All right, let me just jump in and let Joseph. Is that part of the point you were making earlier, Joseph, that that there already is sort of an advantage via the U.S. Senate, and that's a separate matter, but the Electoral College, abolishing the Electoral College in favor of the popular vote wouldn't deprivilege the other states given that scenario?
Yeah, so when we're talking about this, a lot of this is, again, these low population states, and they really are privileged by both the U.S. Senate and to some degree by the Electoral College. I do, again, think the Electoral College is really more about close states, I would say, than necessarily small states in terms of just making Florida the center of the universe every 4 years. But I do think it does give this sort of overrepresentation. And I do want to talk about it in racial terms for a second. We're talking about specifically and usually giving more voice to a certain population of white voters. And I think that's a big part of it.
Okay. Dr. Guelzo, in our last minute here, do you think if the caller is on point that there are a number of advantages for the states we've been talking about and we just abolish the Electoral College, would you fear that that would be a slippery slope to eventually abolishing something like the U.S. Senate?
I think so, because the logic that tells us that we should dispense with the Electoral College is exactly the same logic
sure.
that tells us we should dispense with the Senate. And by the time we've taken out the Electoral College and by the time we've taken out the Senate, what is still standing of the Constitution? Let's deconstruct the whole thing. Is that a road we really want to go down? I don't think so. I think it's one thing for people to say, oh, I'm not certain about the Electoral College. But when you realize that you're really pulling on a thread, then that's when people, I think, start to hesitate.
Yeah, and it sounds to me like our guest, Joseph, feels like there's a lot that we can do within the framework of the Constitution to change this and create a system he would find more fair. Dr. Guelzo sees that as a possible slippery slope. Very different viewpoints. I want to thank both of our guests for elaborating on those views throughout the hour. Joseph Burgess, a data curator at the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at Cornell University. It's good to have you. Thanks for making time for the program.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You got it. And Alan Guelzo is the director of the James Madison Program Initiative on Politics and Statesmanship in the Council of Humanity and the senior research scholar in the Council of Humanities at Princeton University. Dr. Guelzo, thank you for the time, sir.
Thank you, Evan, and thank you, Joseph. Great talk. Great.
Very much appreciated to both of you. Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow.